Yes, well, these meetings have been concerned with the question of thought, or really in the way what it's been doing in the world, right? And just by way of review, we all know that the world is in a difficult situation and has been basically for a long time. That now we have many crises, in addition to the latest one in the Middle East, which has no clear solution. We have also the ecological crisis, which has gone on the back burner, I think. And we have economic crises developing, and we have the fact that there's nationalism all over, and people don't seem to have all sorts of hatreds, and we have religious hatred and inability of people to get together to face the common problems, such as the ecological one or the economic one. Everything is interdependent, and yet the more interdependent we get, it seems the more we split up into little groups that don't like each other and are inclined to fight each other and kill each other, or at least not to cooperate. And so one begins to wonder whether it will be possible, what is going to happen to the human race. Technology keeps on advancing with greater and greater power, either for good or for destruction. And yet it seems that it tends to be used more and more. There's always this danger of destruction. We no sooner had this rivalry between America and the West and the East, or sort of dissolved away, and then we have this problem. The Middle East pops up, and doubtless another one will pop up later, and so on. It's sort of endemic. It's not just something that occasionally happens, and it's in the whole situation. Now, I think we're all familiar with that situation, and if you think of technology advancing, you have nuclear bombs, which will perhaps soon be available to people like Saddam or to somebody else if he goes, and you have biological weapons and chemical weapons and what other kinds of weapons they haven't yet invented, but surely will. And then you have that the faster we go into a depression, which will help save the ecology, or we go into a boom, which will make us happy, but it will ruin the ecology. I mean, the faster we go into prosperity, the faster we create all those other problems. So it seems whichever way you turn, it doesn't work. And why not? You see, what's going on? Is there any way out? You see, can you imagine in 100 years of this, or 200 or 500, it won't lead to some gigantic catastrophe, either to the ecology or in some other way? And perhaps war, who knows? No. So it seems that we have to, people have been dealing with this piecemeal, looking at symptoms, right? Saying we've got to solve this problem or that problem or that problem, but there's something deeper which is constantly generating these problems which people haven't been considering. The way I used to have the analogy that there's a stream and people are pouring pollution upstream and they're trying to remove it downstream. But as they remove it, they may add some more of a different kind. So the what is the source of all this trouble, you see? Now that is really what we've been concerned with in all these dialogues of the past few years, and we're coming back that the source is basically in thought, I'm saying, and those of you who come will have heard this several once or twice or more before. Which many people would think is crazy. You see, that thought is the one thing we have to solve our problems, right? That's part of our tradition. And see, it looks as if the thing we use to solve our problems is the source of our problems. It's like going to the doctor and he'll make you ill. In fact, in 20% of the cases, apparently, we do have that going on. But in the case of thought, it's far over 20%. I say that the So the reason why we don't see the source of our problems is that the means by which we try to solve them are the source. But that may seem strange to somebody who's first heard it, because our whole culture prides itself on thought as its highest achievement. And it's the achievements of thought I'm not trying to say are negligible. They are very great achievements in technology and various other ways and culture. But there's another side to it which is leading to our destruction that we have to look at. Now, what is wrong? I'll try to say what is wrong with thought. I'll try to give some brief summary and we might start talking about it if you like. Well, one of the obvious things wrong with it is fragmentation. thought is breaking things up into bits which should not be broken up. You see, we can see this going on. We see the world is broken up into nations, more and more nations. Russia had no sooner got rid of the communist dictatorship when it's breaking up into a lot of little bits, which obviously can't manage, and they're all fighting each other, and it's a source of concern that they're doing this, a concern for the whole world. Right? You have new nations all over the world. I was reading recently an article about during the Second World War that nationalism developed in Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. As they say, Lithuania for the Lithuanians, Latvia for the Latvians, I don't know, Armenia for the Armenians, and so on and so on. It's all broken up, and yet the world is all one, right? The more technology develops, the more people depend on each other, and people try to pretend it's not so, right? So they say the nation is sovereign, it can do what it like, you see, and yet it can't, right? The United States can't do what it like because it depends a lot on other countries for supplies of all sorts, oil, and it depends on Japan for money, apparently, and so on. So Japan can't do what it like, obviously. It seems very hard for people to accept this simple fact seriously. And nations get to fight each other and kill each other. They say, for the nation you must sacrifice everything, or for your religious differences you sacrifice everything. We split into religions. You see, we split into racial groups and saying that's all important, and all sorts of splits into inside each nation. There are various splits. You can see people are divided up and into sections and into all kinds of interests, and it goes on down to the family and inside families and so on. People are supposed to be getting together, but they can't. And see, the nation, we have the boundary of the nation. You say we've established a nation. Now that's invented by thought, right? If you go to the edge of the nation, there's nothing there particular, unless somebody made a fence, right? it's the same country. The people may often be not very different, but it's all important what's one side or the other. It's thought that makes it so, you see. I was informed that most of the nations in the Middle East were invented either by the British or the French, that their various bureaucrats drew lines and said, that's the boundary of this nation, that nation, that nation, and there they were. Now they all have to fight each other, you see. So the then you have professional groups. If you are in science, you see every little specialty is fragmented from every other, and people hardly know what's happening in a somewhat different field, and it goes on. Knowledge is fragmented. Everything gets broken up. You see, now what is broken up is something. In other words, what we are doing is establishing boundaries where really there's a close connection. That's what's wrong with fragmentation. And at the same time, trying to establish unity where there isn't any, or not very much. Right inside the boundary, we say we're all one. But when you look at all these groups, they're not all one at all. They're all fighting each other inside as much as they're fighting outside. So we have false division and false unification. Right. In other words, thought is pretending that there's a sharp division here, and really everything is unified inside when it's all not so. So this is a fictional way of thinking. The question is, we say, to go on with this fictional way of thinking seems to be very important, so important that the actual fact that it's wrong is ignored. You see, so that it's not that way at all. So See, then it seems strange. Why should people do such a strange thing? See, it seems it's really would be could be thought of as irrational, or at the very least, a crazy, perhaps. You know, that so much trouble is created out of such small things, right? You know, which may prevent our survival even. That fragmentation is itself a symptom of some more general difficulty with thought, or a particular case of it. Because there's a more general difficulty with thought is that thought is very active and participatory. It's always doing a great deal, but it all is tending to say it hasn't done anything. But it's just telling you the way things are, right? You see, thought has created everything you see here in this building around. It has affected how all the trees are. It has affected the mountains. It has affected the plains and the farms and the factories and the science and technology. And even at the South Pole, you have quite a bit of, you have the destruction of the ozone layer, which is basically due to thought, because people thought that they want to have a refrigerant, a nice, safe refrigerant. And they built this all up by thinking more and more about it, and now we have the ozone layer, you see, being destroyed. So, thought has produced tremendous effects outwardly, and we'll discuss further on, it produces tremendous effects inwardly in each person. And yet, the general tacit assumption in thought is that it's just telling you the way things are, not doing anything. And that you are inside there deciding what to do with that information. But I want to say that you don't decide what to do with the information. The information takes over and runs you. You see, that thought runs you. But it also gives the false information that you are running it, right? That you are the one who controls thought, whereas thought is the one who controls each one of us, right? Until thought is understood, or better yet, more than understood, perceived, it will actually control us. But create the impression that it is our servant. It is just doing what we want it to do. That's the difficulty. The thought is participating, and then saying it's not participating. It's taking part. It's in everything. Its fragmentation is a particular case of that. You see, thought is creating divisions out of itself and then saying they're there naturally. The divisions between nations are regarded as being just there, you see. But obviously they were invented by people, and people came to accept them, and that made them be there. The same holds for the divisions between religions. Every religion was invented by somebody thinking that he had a certain idea about God, and that that was right and true, and eventually other religions weren't right. And eventually that you could catch that the other religions were inferior, or perhaps even heretical, or evil or wrong, and you could fight them, you know, try to suppress them and destroy them. And there were vast religious wars, and in fact we may still have some more coming. So in spite of all the development of the enlightened knowledge and science and technology, in fact science and technology now seems to serve at least equally well those who are perhaps at a more medieval level than it serves those who are regard themselves as more advanced, right? Anybody can use it, you see, and without fundamentally altering his own frame of mind, which governs how it's used. Therefore, in saying that thought has this character, that it is doing something and says it didn't do it. Now, we have to really go into that, because we could discuss that a great deal, because what it's doing is very much more subtle than I've said. That's only the beginning. Another problem with fragmentation is that thought divides from feeling and from the body. Thought is said to be the mind, some sort of abstract or spiritual or immaterial. We have that feeling. And then you have the body, very physical, and then you have emotions somewhere in between, perhaps. And the ideas, they're all different, right? Now, we think of them as different, and we experience them as different because we think of them as different, right? But see, thought is not so different from emotion. If you think something, if you think that a certain person has treated you badly, you will get angry, you see. We'll discuss that more later, but a very elementary example is that if somebody keeps you waiting for a couple of hours and you can get very angry thinking, you know, what does he mean treating me like this? You know, he has no consideration for me. And you can think of various things, he's always doing it and so on. By thinking that way, you can get very angry. And then if he comes and says the train was late, it goes. So it shows it's thought, right? By changing your thought, the anger evaporates. So thought at least sustains that feeling. And you can see that thought of something pleasant will make you feel good. You see, the thought that you're doing well and great will make you feel good inside. The adrenaline will be, you know, all the good feelings will come out. And the thought that you have done something wrong, or the thought that you're guilty, may make you feel miserable. If somebody says you are guilty, which is a thought, then you can feel very miserable, right? So feelings are tremendously affected by thoughts, and obviously thoughts are tremendously affected by feelings. Because if you're angry, you don't think clearly. Now, if you have a feeling of pleasure in something, you may find yourself reluctant to give up the idea that gives you pleasure, even if it's wrong. Right? You engage in self-deception. So the feelings and thoughts affect each other, and I gave this example many times, but it's a good one. There's a good physical reason for that, which you can see in the structure of the brain. See, there's a very thick bundle of nerves. There's an intellectual center in the cortex and the outer layers of the brain, and deeper down there's an emotional center. And then between them is a very thick bundle of nerves by which they communicate very closely. So they must be connected, you see. Now then, there was this famous case in the 19th century of an iron pin which an explosion drove through the man's brain. He had been a very level-headed man and so on, but he recovered apparently from this. It came right out, you see, and then he recovered and he was physically okay, but emotionally he was totally unbalanced, and intellectually he couldn't maintain any very consistent line of thought. So the breaking of the connection of the emotional and the intellectual centers prevented the system from functioning. You see, what happens is that the intellectual center will normally tell whether an emotion is appropriate or not. That's what happened when you were angry, somebody being delaying you 2 hours, and somebody else came and said the train was late, you believed him. Then the intellectual center said there's no longer any good reason to be angry, and the emotional center duly said, okay, no reason, I give up my anger. And vice versa, the emotional center may be sending, may send information saying that there is danger, there is this or that, and the intellectual center picks it up and tries to find out what is the danger, it thinks. Therefore, they're intimately and closely related. The very wish to think must come from an emotion or from an impulse to think, they're really almost two sides of the same process, right? But our language separates them and our thought separates them. They're fragmented. You see, we introduce in our thought a very sharp division just back between nations where there really isn't such a division. We're introducing a fictional way of thinking about this situation. And if our thinking is fictional, it will mislead us. So we have this question that emotions and intellect are closely connected, and I think it's worth repeating what I've said the last 2 years, that in the language we have a distinction, thinking and thought, right? Thinking is the present sense of the thing, and some activity going on, which may include some critical sensitivity to what may go wrong, and also some new ideas and perception of some kind of insight occasionally. But then thought is the past of that. So thinking doesn't disappear. Another idea we have is that when we've been thinking something, it just goes, but it doesn't. It goes somehow into the brain and leaves something, a trace, which becomes thought, right? And a thought now acts automatically. So, therefore, if you have been thinking for a while that I have a good reason to be angry, it's there, and then you remain angry. So we have thinking and thought. Thought is the response from memory, from the past, right? Of what has been done. And then you have the word feeling, which suggests that it's always just active present. It's just telling you, it's just directly in contact with reality. But in fact, if we introduce the English word felt, say there are feelings and felts, right? There are feelings which have been recorded. We know that they're there because you may remember pleasure that you had and get a sense of pleasure. You remember pain you had and you get a sense of pain. A traumatic experience in the past can make you feel very uncomfortable when remembered, and so on. So nostalgic feelings and so on, you know, are there from the past. And the there are a lot of the feelings come up are really from the past. They're felts. And by failing to make this distinction, we often give too much importance to some feelings which actually don't have that much significance. If they are recorded, if they're just the recording being replayed, they don't have as much significance as if they were a response to the present immediate situation. Now, see, if you respond according to the way you felt a long time ago or where you got used to feeling, saying, when I was a child, a certain situation made me feel uncomfortable, or, you know, when any similar situation arises, now you feel uncomfortable. You only get that discomfort, but you don't see it, doesn't mean anything, right? But it does seem to mean a great deal. It affects you, right? So that false division between thinking and feeling, and also the whole state of the body, right? Because according to the way you think, you will get adrenaline flowing, you know, you'll get neurochemicals affected all over the body. For example, if you see a shadow and you know that there are people around who might attack you, then you immediately get a feeling of fear and you get adrenaline flowing, your muscles tense, your heart beats, just from the knowledge that there may be assailants in the neighborhood. As soon as you look and say it's a shadow, it goes, the knowledge that this doesn't happen to be one of those assailants, and it goes, right? So there's a profound connection between the state of the body and the way you think. And if people are constantly worried about under stress, about their jobs or something, then they may stir up their stomachs too much and get ulcers, you know, and various other things, and it's well known. So the state of the body is very profoundly tied to thought, right? Affected by thought and vice versa. So, that's another kind of fragmentation we have to watch out for, right? Now, all of that will tend to introduce quite a bit of confusion, or what I call incoherence, into our thinking, or into our action. Because what happens is that you will not get the results you expect. You see, that's the major sign of incoherence. You want to do something, but it doesn't come out that way, right? That's a sign that you have some wrong information somewhere, usually. I mean, if you expect something, you act that way and it doesn't happen. Is that clear? And the right approach would be to say, yes, that's incoherent. Let me try to find out the wrong information and change it. But now, the trouble is we find there's a lot of incoherence where people don't do that. You see, if somebody likes to be flattered, you see, in some sense, he also doesn't want to be taken advantage of, right? But he finds that the person who flatters him can take advantage of him, right? It happens again and again and again, and he doesn't want that. But so you would say, well, there's an incoherence there because it is not his intention to be taken advantage of, right? But still, he has another intention he doesn't think about, which is he wants the glow of feeling that would come from flattery, right? Now, one implies the other, because if he accepts that then he also will accept the truth of what the person says, and a lot of other things he can be taken advantage of. So he's got incoherent, he's got a conscious intention, and another one which is resist going against it, right? That's a very common situation. It's the same between with nationalism. You see, people didn't set up nations in order to suffer the way they've suffered, to suffer endless wars and hate and starvation and disease and annihilation and slavery and whatnot. That was not their intention when they set up a nations to do that, but that's what happened. And it would inevitably happen. Now, the point is nobody ever looked at the nation and said, what's it all about? They said, at all costs, we have got to go on with this nation, but we don't want these consequences. Right? And therefore, they struggled against the consequences without, well, they kept on producing the situation. See, that is a third feature of thought, that it doesn't know it's doing something, and then it struggles against that. It doesn't want to know it's doing it, right? And it struggles against the result, trying to avoid the unpleasant result while keeping on with the way of thinking. See, that's what I call sustained incoherence, you see. Now, there would be simple incoherence, which you're always going to have, because thoughts are always incomplete. You know, we always find our thoughts are not quite right. And we therefore have to say, if we find out what's happening becomes contradictory, confused, or isn't doing what we expect, then we should change our thoughts, right? And try to make it better. And in simple situations, we do, right? But when it comes to things that matter to us, we don't. Now, that's rather odd, because in the things that matter are the place where we ought to be coherent, especially. But we feel that only the things that don't matter too much we can afford to be coherent, right? See, which is another kind of incoherence, because we really, nobody has the intention of producing that sort of situation. We see, we are producing these situations contrary to our conscious intentions. There's another resistance going on, which we're not very conscious of. So whenever we intend to do something, we often have unconsciously a resistance trying to prevent us from doing it. It's a big waste of energy, obviously. And anyway, it's very destructive. It means we will produce problems without end that have no solution. In other words, see, suppose we say, well, the Russians finally and the West got together finally for various reasons, but meanwhile, for various other reasons, people have been sending a lot of arms into the Middle East. Right? It was not their intention to produce this impossible situation we have now. They said, well, we're sending arms to the Middle East for various reasons. You know, we want to make money, some of us, or we have a certain national policy which calls for doing that. There are various reasons, right? And then it all added up to this situation. Right? If there had been no arms there, it would not be so serious. So, also, in 73, it was plainly brought out that we were very dependent on Middle Eastern oil, which was a very unstable region. For a while, people began to use oil more efficiently, or energy more efficiently, but then gradually they stopped, right? And then they say, look, surprise, we now depend for half the oil of the world is theirs. if that goes, we're all finished, right? So the, once again, see, it was not people's intention to produce this situation, but rather, they may say, we don't want this situation, but there are a lot of other things we've got to have which will produce this situation, is that clear? So there was an incoherence, right? We're constantly producing things we don't intend. Then we say, look, we've got a problem. We don't realize that it was our hidden intentions which have produced it, and keep on. Even now, very little is being done, as far as I can see, about using energy more efficiently and thus becoming less dependent on that oil, which would remove almost the whole problem. Now, you must ask, why is there this incoherence? I mean, nobody wants that situation, and yet people want things which will inevitably produce it, right? They think it's thought that makes people say that's necessary. See, so therefore thought has come to this kind of incoherence, and I think that's really the kind of introduction. maybe we should talk a little about it now, and I'd say a little more later about this whole thing, if people want to discuss it. Or is that too depressing to discuss?
Taking on the point about thinking and thought and the difference, you're proposing that you slide from thinking into thought without being aware we've done it?
Yeah. Well, it's automatic, you see, because when we've been thinking, it gets recorded somewhere. Then that becomes thought. I'll discuss later how that thought is an active set of movements, right? A reflex. You see, suppose you keep on thinking. See, the people of that start out with very young children. People of that group are no good, no good, no good. And then it becomes thought, which just springs up. They're no good. In fact, you hardly notice that you're thinking, that there's any thought even, right?
Even now in conversation in this group, while you're talking, there's a process of thinking, and which is, as you said, alive, or more in the present. And then there's other stuff happening in us, which is thought, and we don't seem to have the ability to distinguish the two.
No, well, we don't seem to distinguish the two. We say, sometimes we do, because sometimes we say, I thought that before, you know. But generally, we may miss the distinction. And with feeling, it's even harder to see that distinction between what we, with the past feeling coming up, I call it the felt, and something which would be an active present feeling, right?
I wonder how much of the fracturing is taught in the Newtonian and Christian models, Judeo-Christian model of the fracturing. And how much is our brain intrinsic, and is this actually its behavior, its normal, natural behavior? I mean, I remember in grade schools being taught to fracture, classify, and disorganize, take things apart. And my interior was violently against it because I saw this whole knitted skein as an uneducated person. So I'm wondering whether the brain naturally wants to fracture and analyze, or whether it's part of the way we teach ourselves.
Well, it is to some extent part of the result of the way we are taught, I'm sure. I think there is some tendency in thought to constantly build this up, you see.
So you think it's partly intrinsic, and it's part of the nature of the brain?
Not the brain. Well, in the way thought has been developing, you see, I think, first of all, a certain amount of analysis is necessary for clarity of thought. Some distinctions have to be made, right? Now, we then carry them too far without, we slip over. And once we carry them too far, then we start registering it, and that becomes part of our habit, right?
How do we recognize where the edge before slipping over too far?
Well, that's a very subtle question, and we want to go into that carefully in this whole period. But I don't think you're going to recognize. See, I think it's, you'll see that something much deeper is involved. To see, to get free of that is much more than just recognizing that difference, right? But what we have to do is to see some sort of notion of where what sort of trouble we're in now, right? In other words, we started out saying the trouble is the world is in chaos, but I think we end up by saying that thought is in chaos, right? And that's each one of us. And that is the origin of the world in chaos, right? And then the chaos of the world comes back and adds to the chaos of thought.
Did you mean to say that thought has a kind of possessive quality in which it stays, gets stuck, and then become habitual, and then we don't see it?
Yeah, well, I think everything has that sort of quality, that whenever we repeat something, it sort of gradually becomes a habit. Perhaps I'll discuss that presently, but it will be a key point, you see, and we get less and less aware of it, right? You know, you just, if you brush your teeth every morning, you probably hardly notice how you're doing it, right? It's it just goes by itself. Our thought just does the same thing, and so do our feelings, right?
The employment of thought in the psychological sense, is that not synonymous with corruption?
Why do you say that?
Is there not only two states, corruption and innocence?
Well, I don't know. You see, but why? You see, I'm not saying yes or no. I'm trying to say, why are you saying this? You see, in other words, are you saying that thought by itself is incapable of innocence? Or that we simply be...
In the psychological sense, it seems so.
Yeah, well, is it so is the question. So it may seem so.
I don't know, sir.
Yeah, that's the question we're trying to explore, right? See, we'll admit the fact is it seems so. It seems as an appearance, right? Now the question is what is actually the case, right? And we have to explore that. Right, you see what I mean? That this will take some digging into. We can't just take the way things seem and just work on that, because that would be another kind of mistake thought makes, just taking the surface and calling it the reality, right?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting what you say. I can see how, you know, if I have the intention to go someplace and I take the wrong road, it's no problem. I just, you know, next time I find out what the right road is, I change the information and I take a different road. But if both personally and collectively, often I have the intention to do something and it doesn't work out, and yet I don't know what's wrong, and I can't seem to change the information or whatever. And what I'm very interested in especially is how there's a sense of me separate from the information and from the intention, and I feel like I'm this objective being that can change it, and yet I can't seem to, or the world can't seem to. So the sense of me separate from the information, I think that's something interesting to explore.
Yes, well, we will try to get into that during this whole period. You see, that's another subtle question, but we have that feeling, as you say, that what seems to be, and we don't necessarily accept what seems to be. See, if we accept what seems to be as what is, then we can't inquire. I mean, if what seems to be were perfectly coherent, then I'd say, all right, why question it? But since it's highly incoherent, I would say a good reason to question it. That would be common sense in most in ordinary areas of life. Now, it seems that all that's happening, that we all want to do things and we can't do what we want. Something else seems to happen that stops it. Now, that's... See, some of the people who are running corporations are getting interested in this question because they have the same problem. And I know some people who are working in this area, and they find that when their boards get together, they can't seem to get the result. They can't agree, and they can't get the results they intend either. That's one of the reasons that they're sinking a bit. And the once again. Now, but there's a fellow who has written a book, Peter Senge, The Fifth Discipline. He has analyzed some of these. I don't say he's got to the bottom of it, but it's interesting. He has made some sort of analysis which shows that very often it's because they are not following the effect of their thoughts. You see, that when they think something and something is done, then it spreads out to other companies, and then it comes back a bit later as if it were something else, right? Independent, is that clear? So they treat it as an independent problem, and they keep on, thereby making it worse because they keep on doing the same thing. So their way of thinking is creating a problem. It takes some time for the problem to get back to them. By that time, they've lost track of it. And they say, here's a problem. And they think some more, and they produce more of that problem. Or else change the problem a bit into another one that's worse, or whatever. So the point is that they're not following, you see, that they are not aware of the effects of their thought, right? That the fact thought is active, participating. Now, you see, there is this feeling that when you are thinking something, it does nothing except inform you the way things are. And then you choose to do something and you do it. That's the way people are talking, right? Hmm? But the way you think determines the way you're going to do it. And then you don't notice a result comes back, right? You don't see it as a result of what you've done, or even less do you see it as a result of how you were thinking. Hmm? Is that clear? So therefore your problem, you see, all these problems that I described are the result of the way we've been thinking, that whole series of them which are so depressing. But people don't see that. They say, we're just thinking. Out there are the problems, and the thinking is telling us about those problems, what they are.
So if I see a situation which seems so very obvious that a whole group of people are acting very incoherently, and then I think I see it very clearly that they're being incoherent, and then I start to act to correct that, I mean, I'm not noticing that my own thinking and my own may be incoherent, and the action then will be all...
No, because you're not thinking, you may be caught in the same thing, you see. Yeah. In fact, you see that... Because actually, how will you correct it? You see, unless their thinking changes, it won't be corrected. Now, nothing you do can change their thinking, except communication to them that they're incoherent. Well, communication which they will accept and understand. Is that clear? Otherwise, you are trying to meet thought with force, really, and it's kind of violence. You see. If you say, out there are some people behaving incoherently and I will try to make them behave coherently, then you're using force, right? But they keep on thinking the same old way. If you're more powerful than they are, they will do what you want for a while until you get to be a little weak and they'll take care of you then.
So, the possessive quality of thought, if I can bring it back again, it seems to me, it appears, I would like to explore it. Thought comes in from the outside, comes to the awareness, takes over, takes possession, and maybe collectively take possession, and
yeah.
We can go to war and we don't see it, because thought is possessive like magic. It seems to take over.
Yes, it takes over, and why does it take over? You see, the point is, there are two levels of this point. One is to describe the what happens as far as we can see outwardly, and secondly, to see the source of it, right? Because unless we see the source of it, it will never change.
So how can we explore the source?
Yeah, well, that's what we're going, that's what this whole this weekend is about, right? You see, but I think it's important to see what the question is. You see, the first thing is to see there is a question that needs to be explored, right? Right back there.
Can thought be aware of itself?
Well, that's a subtle question. You see, I think we'd have to, perhaps it would be best to leave that go for a while. On the surface, it appears it wouldn't be aware of itself if it's just memory. We need some kind of awareness of what thought is doing, let's put it that way, that seems clear, but which we don't have, generally speaking.
What's that word you use?
I used the word in previous times, proprioception, self-perception of thought, you see. And we'll come to that, you know, as we go along, that there may be a way to get into this. But, I mean, I think, you know, we should look at, you know, the thing, you know, and sort of a general way at this and for this evening. It would take us rather longer than this evening would make available to go into that. Now, it's not by any means, it doesn't look entirely impossible that something we could approach this question somehow, but it is a very difficult question. You see, there are two reasons why it's difficult, which I would put. One of them is that there's a fault in the process of thought, which what I mean by thought is all the whole thing, thought, felt, the body, the whole society sharing thoughts. It's all one process. It's essential for me not to break that up, because that's all one process, And somebody else's thoughts become my thoughts, you see, and vice versa. So therefore, it would be wrong and misleading to break it up into my thought, your thought, my feelings, these feelings, those feelings. For some purposes, all right, but not for this purpose we're in now. Now, the now I would say that this thought makes what is now often called in modern language a system. A system means it's all put together, but it really, the way they're using the word commonly now, it means something all of whose parts are mutually interdependent for their, not only for their mutual action, but for their meaning and their existence. You see, you could say if you organize a corporation, that is a system. You see, you have this department, that department, that department. They don't have any meaning separately, right? They all only can function together. Now, in some sense, the body is a system. Right? Maybe society is a system in some sense. Now, all the and so on. Now, I want to say that thought is a system. Thought, that system is not only includes felt feelings. It includes the state of the body. It includes the whole of society as its thought is passing back and forth. And a whole process by which thought evolved from ancient times or even before, right? A system is constantly engaged in a process of development, change, evolution, its structure changes, and so on. Now, there are certain features of the system become relatively fixed. We call that the structure. You can see that in an organization, there's a certain structure. And that sometimes begins to break up because it doesn't work and people could change it, right? Now, So we've got some structure in thought as well. I don't know if you can see some of it, but which are some relatively fixed features. But it's been constantly evolving, you see. So we can't say that this structure began, never, you know, you can't say when it began, but with the growth of civilization, it has developed a great deal. It was probably very simple thought before civilization. And now it has become very complex and ramified and has much more incoherence than before. So you have this system, right? And now I say that this system has a fault, and a systemic fault. It's not a fault here, or there, or there, but it is a fault that is all through the system. Right? Can you picture that? It's everywhere and nowhere, you see. Therefore, you may say, I see a problem here, but I bring my thought to bear on the problem, but my thought is part of the system. It has the same fault as the fault I'm trying to look at, or a similar fault. So we have the systemic fault, and you see, you can see that that's what's been going on in all these problems of the world, that the fragmentation of nations has produced problems, and in dealing, we say, here is a fault, something is going wrong. But in dealing with it, we use the same kind of fragmentary thought that produced the problem, just a somewhat different version of it. So, therefore, it's not going to help and make things worse. So, for example, you were saying, you know, you see all these things going wrong, and then you say, but what shall I do? I try to think about it. But my thought by now is pervaded with this systemic fault. Is that clear?
Yes.
So what does that call for?
Is it like the whole system has been polluted?
Well, that's one way of looking at it, yes. Something has happened in the whole system which makes the thought wrong in the whole process, not straight in the whole system. Right? Any part of it, there may be bits of it which are okay, but you know, it doesn't stay, right? I mean, you extend it. It's a bit like, I used to say, like the thing of saying the egg which was rotten only in parts. You see, there might be some parts which haven't been rotten, but they'll spread, right? You see, so we can get some relatively clear thought in science, right? It's not entirely clear because scientists are worried about their prestige and status and so on. Sometimes they won't consider ideas that won't go along with that or with their prejudices or whatever, but Nevertheless, science was aimed at not having that, right? It was aimed at seeing this fact, whether you like it or not, and looking at theories, you know, objectively and calmly and, you know, without bias and so on. And then to some extent it was achieved better than in some other areas of life, right? So therefore some results flowed out of science and technology which are quite impressive. A great power was released, and then but now we discover that in the use of science, whenever the time comes to use science, we just forget the scientific method, right? We just say, well, no, that was nice for the scientists to use the scientific method to make all that. From now on, we say, well, the use of this thing will be determined by needs of our country, by my need to make money, or by need to defeat that religion, or, you know, whatever, right? Or just my need to show what a great, powerful person I am, right? So, therefore, we now say, relatively unpolluted thought has been used to develop certain things, and then we always trust to the most polluted thought to decide what to do with it. Well, that's part of the incoherence. I'm just repeating it, but it's being
are you saying that as we get into this pollution, we cannot see our true intentions?
Well, not only that, we don't know what our, we don't see that our intentions are incoherent, and perhaps that they are arising out of the pollution.
I think as an individual, you know, we strive to resolve these things in ourselves, that what are our intentions and as individuals, what causes us to act or think the way we do. And at the same time, I see that part of the problems you describe, the global problems, are a different kind of problem that individuals haven't faced. You know, for example, individuals want to survive and want to reproduce. That's no longer possible in the sense that it was before, because a lot of our problems are we have too many people. So there's both a working on this as an individual and somehow collectively realizing that we can't do the basic things individuals used to need to do, that something has to be changed.
Yes, so that's quite true, but you see, we can't seem to do it. You see, that the people trying to get together to deal with these things don't seem to be able to get very far. You know, like take the pollution or the ecological, the climate, you know, the change of climate, or very little has been done on it. You see, a lot of good words have been produced by various governments, but when it comes to putting a lot of money behind it, it hasn't got very far, you see. And therefore, there's very good intentions are counteracted by another set of intentions, or a whole bunch of sets of intentions, such as we've got to allow, we can't interfere with this, we can't interfere with that, we've got to allow this and that and that, and then it adds up to nothing. So the therefore, it's the same incoherence that the intentions we profess are blocked by another set that we not only don't profess, but may not know fully we've got. We may not want to know. Right?
It seems to me that we have to, like, become aware of certain assumptions which we've completely taken for granted and aren't even aware that we have. And that seems like we kind of have to go backwards and, you know, just question what our assumptions are that we're taking for granted in the way we, in the system, in how we operate all the time. Because there's something that we're not even noticing, which is limiting our ability to make our intentions happen, both individually and collectively.
Well, you see, we're faced with this thing that I think we're not really aware of what's happening in this system which I've called thought, right? We don't know how it works. We hardly know it's a system. You see, it's not part of our culture to admit that it's a single system even, right?
Explain that system again. You said we're going to discuss the thought, but you were also including the emotional.
Yeah.
And what else were you including?
The state of the body and also the whole society, the culture, the way we pass information between us and emotions and everything.
Now, when you say the state of the body, are you also including the organs of the body?
Well, anything, yes. The organs are affected by it.
Okay. Okay, so when you say the organs are affected by it, in a sense you're making a distinction. Are you saying everything is... Somehow I'm hearing that you're saying this whole thing is a system, a closed system.
Well, I wouldn't say it's entirely closed. A system isn't necessarily closed. It can be open to various influences or things coming in and out. That's the whole idea of a system. But you see that... it's not necessarily closed, but it has a certain stability of structure. It tends to sustain and maintain its structure, so that when something from outside comes in, it reacts in such a way as to avoid a change, a basic change, right?
Right, but I'm hoping you're going to say that there is a possibility of opening up the structure or seeing it or being...
There is, yes. I'm not saying the system is everything there is. I'm saying the system pervades our whole activity.
Yes, I understand that.
Do you get the distinction? It's like something pervading our activity, but it doesn't mean that it's all there is. But it actually has become so pervasive it may be almost all that we are able to see much at the time.
So what is not in the system? Can we say what is not part of the system?
Well, yes. Well, we could say for the beginning that perhaps there is some kind of perception or intelligence which is... which is deeper, which is able to see this incoherence. You see, for example, if we say that the system itself could not very well see its incoherence very far, because it would distort it. I'm suggesting there is a capacity that this system could be regarded as some sort of as we've said. To a certain extent, it is necessary because we need this whole system of thought and so on for all sorts of purposes. Now, it has produced, has developed a fault. Now, there is, I say, an intelligence and a perception which goes beyond memory. We can't see a fact or can't see an incoherence just simply by way of, that's the first step. There's a lot beyond this system. The system is actually only a very tiny part of reality, but it looms very large, and it would be very, unless you actually see the thing I'm talking about, what I say will be incorporated into the system as an image, which will not really convey. You see what I mean? Is that clear? What the problem is? You see that the system tends to incorporate everything. Anything repeated several times becomes a perception, and then repeated several times becomes part of the system. So somebody may have had an insight, and then it becomes part of the system.
You excluded memory, intuition from the system, didn't you?
Well, it doesn't mean, it depends on what you mean by it. I think the system is able to have a kind of intuition that, in the sense that it may imitate. It may give a memory of intuition, which sort of feels a bit like intuition, you see.
But intuition would not be part of the system, would it?
Not if it were truly so, yes. But I'm saying there's perception, insight, there's intelligence, there's various things you can call it, which we'll try to bring it all out as we go along, which may not be part of the system. But let's put it now that I don't think it's that way, and that we're keeping it as a possibility, and we all may see some evidence that system is not everything.
Hmm? Aren't there times that an action is considered right by the individual, and of course that action taking place is a result of what you might call non-self-serving thought, and yet not trying to impose it on someone, but where there's a strong elements of, say, compassion and love in that particular thought. Now, in that sense, isn't the fragmentation of thought is not really necessarily a part of that activity? Is particularly if the point of not being imposed, particularly there's that sense of compassion and love in that action.
Such compassion and love, then I would say it's not part of the system, clearly. But of course, a lot of what is felt to be compassion and love is actually part of the system. Because, once again, such experiences, become repeated, become produce experiences that are felt to be the same. You see, it's this deceptive feature that we have to watch out for. That it's just in the question of what is not part of the system where the worst confusion takes place, right? Because, see, if you confuse part of the system as not part of the system, then you're lost, right? And so you have to be very careful about that, right? You see, that it's no use just saying love will take care of everything. You see, people have said that for ages and it hasn't done it, right? And the Christian religion was based on the idea that God is love, and they said we have one God who is pure love, and so on, Christ. And nevertheless, they fought each other, not only fought other religions, but they fought each other very violently over very violent religious wars lasting centuries and so on, with the terrible things. Now, I'm sure that these people didn't intend to get into that, you see, but because of the way they were thinking about their religion, they couldn't help it. They had another intention. The theological question took over, for example, from love, or the question of the religion being connected with the monarch or power or this or that. You see, so it doesn't stop it to just say we're all based on love, because nevertheless it still can be absorbed into the system, right?
It can be an invention of the system.
What?
It can be an invention of the system, talking about love.
Yes, well, and also, yes, well, if you like to call it an invention, or see, I'll try to develop that a little later, how to look at that, now, does anybody else, did you have something?
Well, it's just that if my whole life, all that I've ever known, lies within the system, then any notion of there being anything outside of that is only a notion of the system. And I can't have any idea what that would mean.
Yeah, well, yes, we don't know what it means, but we have to entertain the idea. You see, I think we have to be careful not to paint ourselves into a corner there. You see, that to say everything is in the system, there's no way out of it.
Well, I'm not saying that, it's just that I might get the notion that I could visualize something which was outside, and that would be...
That would still be inside, you see.
Right.
And see, that's why I say that becomes the most dangerous source of confusion, because then you say, that's outside, that's all right. So in that way, thought produces something that says to be outside, and it doesn't say, notice that that's one of the basic mistakes. Thought produces that and says, I didn't produce it, it's really there.
So when you're saying that, in a way, we should see the... Well, no, let me put it differently. So you're saying that we should see the difference between what is the system and what is not the system, instead of using thought to establish a boundary there, which probably would lead to a fragmentation.
If we could see it, but you see, I don't know how are we going to see it is the question, you see.
Sensitivity. I guess I'm just wondering, I mean, there have been a lot of times when people have had insights into particular systems, or, you know, become aware of something and made a major change, like there was, you know, pre-science and then there was science, or there's a lot of examples like that where people did have a change, a radical change in a more limited sphere. I'm wondering if looking at how they did it in that area would be useful or relevant to, you know, getting to the root of this whole system.
Well, do you have something in mind?
Well, yeah, like that, I guess, like how they went from, how did human beings manage to go from never having science to having science, for example?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, that's an interesting point, and that, you know, how was it possible for scientific knowledge to develop, which was quite contrary to the previous culture? And see, that's an interest. See, that required what I would like to call insight. Now, I can give you several examples. You see, in Greek times and ancient, and also in the, up through the Middle Ages, people believed it. See, the ancient Greek idea was that the Earth was at the center of the universe, and there were seven crystal spheres of increasing perfection. That heaven was there. The seventh one was the perfect one, and then saying that celestial bodies should, being perfect, should move in perfect figures. The only perfect figure is a circle. So therefore, they said they ought to be moving in circles, huh? Right? But, see, so and then when they found they weren't, they said, well, it's not actually a circle, but we can make it up out of circles on top of circles called epicycles, and save the appearances, as they said. But the basic idea was this order of increasing perfection, and also the idea that each thing is striving to reach its right place. It was a highly organic view of the universe, right? Mm. Everything had its place and so on. And but when people found that it wasn't working too well, they tended to move to save it rather than to question it seriously, right? Mm. Now, gradually evidence accumulated, especially after the end of the Middle Ages, that there wasn't a great difference of heavenly and earthly matter. You see, for example, the moon, for example, had a lot of irregular features on it. It wasn't very perfect, and other planets had satellites, not only the Earth, and so on. You see that. You didn't see a lot of evidence that heavenly matter and earthly matter were all that different, right? Mm. But still, there was the idea that heavenly matter is basically different. Mm. Mm. It's heavenly, it's perfect. Mm. It belongs up there, it stays up there where it belongs. Huh? Mm. Mm. And therefore, everybody was satisfied, you see. Mm. Now, but there was a gradually... but. There was enough evidence by the time of Newton or even before to question that seriously, but many people may have done so, but not. There's a sort of an unconscious level where it still works, right? Mm. Saying, why does the moon stay up in the sky? It's only natural, it's celestial matter, it stays up where it belongs, right? Mm. You see, nobody worries about why it isn't falling, right? So, that explanation may have made sense in ancient times, but there was enough evidence to question it now. But there's a whole habit in the mind not to question it, right? Let's take it for granted. And then you see the story is, whether it's true or not, I don't know, that Newton was watching the apple fall, and he must have had the insight that, see, the question may have been in the mind, why isn't the moon falling? And he suddenly had the answer, the moon is falling. Right, that's the force of universal gravitation, right? That everything is falling toward everything. Hmm. And then he had to explain why it doesn't reach the ground, which he was able to do later by some calculation, showing it was also going outward. Because it was far away, it was moving away in a fast orbit that kept it off the ground, right? While it was still falling. Hmm. So he had an insight, he must have had an insight at that moment, you see, which broke that old mold of thought, right? Hmm. Saying, why people would ask, if anybody ever asked why the moon isn't falling, he wouldn't even bother with the question, right? Because it was so natural that it belongs, it stays where it belongs. But then, by breaking that thought, then from there on, the key point of the insight was to break the old mold of thought, right? From there on, it was not so difficult to go to the new one, because you could say, if the moon is falling, then there is universal gravitation, everything is falling, and you can then go on from there. So there were other cases of that kind, you see, but and this led to the more modern view, but now this more modern view is just as rigidly fixed as the ancient view was. You see, it would take some sort of something to break that too, right? Now, to say that that is the absolute truth, final, no more questions need to be asked, and so on. See that there is an insight which is possible, and we'll come back to this again, which can break that old mode of thought. We have to really look at that. You know, think about it, first think about it and then see what we can see. And that opens the way to something else. Hmm? Now, of course, it only broke in some limited domain, right? It didn't break in this vast area that we've been talking about. All these insights in science were ultimately assimilated within the system, right?
When you say we have to think about it, isn't that the system doing the thing?
It may be or may not be. I'm trying to say See, I think we shouldn't have prejudged the issue. I'm saying it may be possible in a flash for suddenly some real thinking to take place. It must happen occasionally, or else where would we be? I mean, we would never have got anywhere at all, right? If we use the kind of thought we use in nationalism to deal with practical problems all the time, we would have been dead long ago, you see.
It would be correct to say that that Newton's insight was seeing that the natural state of everything is not motionlessness, but...
Well, that was even before that, you see, that there was already another insight, which was that the natural state of thing is to be in motion. You see, that I didn't give the full story of it. I sort of focused on one point of gravitation.
Maybe a how of what you were saying was very interesting in the fact that he was able to question the wrong question that he wasn't supposed to ask. It was kind of a forbidden question to question what was religious, this was not supposed to ask, and then breaking the pattern of thinking.
Well, you see, it often happens that when you ask what you call a wrong question, there's a question which already assumes the thing that ought to be questioned, you see. It's called begging the question. Now, I don't know whether he was asking. People were generally asking the wrong questions because they were not aware of the importance of the question of why the moon isn't falling, right? So they might have asked, why is the moon going from here to there? Why is this planet going in this particular set of epicycles and so on? See, that would have been the wrong question because it would have assumed all these epicycles which are not really relevant in the actual situation. So therefore you're led, because you don't question that whole structure, you're led to ask a lot of other questions that have no great meaning. And they get you in deeper. Now, see, your questions contain assumptions, that's the point, right? Therefore, when you question the question, you are questioning a deeper assumption, right? But that's done nonverbally. Do you see what I mean? To question the question eventually has to be a nonverbal act which you can't describe.
And as it happens, it breaks all the pattern.
Yes, somehow it breaks the pattern. We want to go into that a lot today. You see, in other words, that this pattern is not just something that, you know, we're stuck with, it's inevitable, absolutely inevitable. There are signs that it could break, right?
What do you mean when you say that it's nonverbal?
Well, I don't know. You see, if I say I have a question which may contain assumptions that should be questioned, right? I could question them verbally, but you see, well, what would lead me to question my question? Eventually I can put it in words, but I'm saying the first step, the first flash of insight is not verbal. Do you see what I mean?
Well, those perceptions were in the absence of thought, and then thought became a product of the perception.
Yeah, it was affected by the perceptions, right? It took a new turn because of those perceptions.
If that insight isn't thought, then what is it?
Well, I don't know. You see, we really have to go into that carefully. You see, how would we answer that? You see, I can ask a question. if we're answering it by thought, then thought can't answer it. Right? You see, so, but on the other hand, thought could still say something about it, which might help us toward the question. Right? See, we're not trying to say thought is always a culprit or always bad. It can also sometimes, in many cases, be right, not only technically, but in other areas. But you see, I think that kind of thought that would come in a thing like this, you see, is a sudden feeling of waking up a bit, right?
On the inside, is there an unlimited pool of insight that any one of us could be in touch with if there's a pause in thought?
Well, maybe, you see, I mean, see, how would I answer it again, you see?
where does this insight...
No, but I'm trying to say, look at the question, you see. I'm saying this is a matter of learning to question the question. Is there an assumption there that I could tell you yes or no? If I can't tell you, then what are we going to do?
Look into the question.
Yeah. You see, don't answer it right away. You see, it may. Newton took a long time before he even got to the question. And he was quite bright.
Can a conception take place that help us to see the, how impatient we are, meaning the, how thought is likes to have too fast explaining answers?
Well, we can look at that too. We want the answer right away, and
Make that help us to start being a little bit more careful or slow down.
But why do we want the answer right away?
Get on with another question.
Is that right? I don't know if that means we're not interested in the question, you see.
Hmm?
I mean, if our real interest is to get on with another question, then we're not going to do this one very well.
Maybe it's like
That's what we do.
Maybe it's like the computer which wants right away to have informations and conclusions, informations and assumptions right away. Maybe it is the nature of the machinery. The machine is the nature of thought.
Well, that may be, but then we have to ask, you know, why do we allow ourselves to be subjugated by this machinery? Right?
Could it be that it gives us security to get the answer real quickly, and we feel oriented, and it gives us a sensation of security?
Yeah, well, that may all be, but you see, you could have said the same about Newton, that if he had the, he may have wanted the answer right away. This question may have been disturbing, and you know, to raise fundamental questions even in science can be very disturbing. And somebody could feel, I'd like to have the answer right away and get out of this unpleasant state of disturbance, and he would never get anywhere. Right?
Generally, it's uncomfortable not to know something.
Yeah, but then Newton must have been in some state of not knowing, or other scientists, I don't want to pick on Newton, who must have been in some state of not knowing for some period, or some state of even confusion and very unpleasant, you know, incoherence and some possibly unpleasant feelings, right? Hmm?
Hmm? Well, maybe he had an intuition.
Well, not that came, but I think he worked on it quite a while. I mean, he must have gone through long periods when it needn't have been always pleasant. Right? Hmm?
So to some extent, we have to sustain the incoherence.
What do you mean?
To sustain in the way that, not to get rid of it immediately when it comes.
Yeah, you see, it's a mistake to try to get rid of the incoherence before you actually get rid of it, right? If you see what I mean. I mean, you only create, the system creates the appearance or the seeming of getting rid of it. No, so, you see, if you're, we seem, the system seems to want to relieve the pressure without actually getting to the root of the thing. Well, that's again the same problem and the same flaw in another way, isn't it? That same fault that we've been talking about, that we don't stay with, that's a pervasive fault in the system. It doesn't stay with a difficult problem that produces unpleasant feelings. It's conditioned somehow to move as fast as it can toward more pleasant feelings without actually facing the thing that's making the unpleasant feeling.
That thing about the unpleasant feeling and the confusion, that might be a learned thing that comes later. Because I've seen a child attempting to do some sort of puzzle, say, and without any sense of confusion or pain, just interest, again and again and again, attempting until maybe finally they succeeded. And so I wonder, I've been thinking about that. Does learning come out of confusion? Well, or does learning come out of a willingness to face something that doesn't have any immediate answer, but it isn't necessarily unpleasant? It's just sort of an abeyance.
That may well be, but we have to consider the state of the system which has evolved with our civilization over thousands and thousands of years, which is that we have a lot of bad experience connected with not having the answers, and one way or another. And therefore, there's a reaction immediately. You want the answer right away. And there's a feeling of, there's the memory of all the unpleasant experiences of not having the answer, right? Those felt bob up, right?
Many children are pushed to have the right solution.
Well, they're rewarded with the right solution, and they face a certain amount of unpleasantness if they don't have it. And the educational system does that. The whole economic system does that. See, everything has grown. The political system, it has all grown up to do that, right? Now, that's by now part of the system. So we have to say, here we are in the system, and what are we going to do with it? So if we face, if there is unpleasantness, it would be very fine to say we shouldn't have it. That would be very good. But since we have it, we have to say, what are we going to do with it? What will be our response?
Can we get sensitive to that here?
Yeah, well, let's see if we can.
It seems that it's not just an intellectual thing, even listening to our voices here, our mind and moving around. There's a it is so-ness tone in the way that we talk to each other, which is, and the little kid picks it up, and that's, I know.
Right, well, can we face it here? Is there any unpleasantness here in facing the uncertainty or the unknown? You see, if there is, you'll notice there's a tremendous movement away from, that's the system set up to move away from that, right? From awareness of that. Now, you can see that if we, by inference, by just thinking about it clearly, we can see that if we keep on doing that, that it makes no sense and the result must be a real disaster, right? You see, yet we find, so we could say, my intention is not to do it, but you'll still have the, still find yourself doing it. So you have a sort of resistance coming from something else, huh? From the system, for whatever we'll call it for the moment.
Would one part of the fault in the system that we do not understand what is the role of incoherence in learning and in the system, that we either try to get out of it immediately, or else we sustain it indefinitely. We don't seem to find the middle golden mean or the middle way with incoherence, in a way letting it unfold itself sufficiently for us to understand what's going on.
Well, sometimes we do. I think we understand perfectly well how that works, because everybody does it in areas where they're not too important to him.
We would need sensitivity to see what's with the meaning.
Yeah, but again, the system is not sensitive, you see. It destroys it. You see that the system interferes with it, right?
But then are you saying we do not actually see the incoherence of not, responding to incoherence in the moment?
I don't know whether we see
it. Matter.
Do we see it or don't we see it? It's a bit puzzling, isn't it? You see, sometimes it seems we see it. You see, in an elementary technical sense, when you see incoherence and it's not worrying you or frightening you, you actually do all that you said, don't you? People do use incoherence. They begin to look at it and do exactly what you said. And if they're not too worried about it, that's exactly what people do. But when people find it's something important to them, then they can't seem to do it, right?
It seems to me that in what you're saying here, we have to re-educate our system, and to understand that when we're in this state of confusion or anxiety of not having an answer, that there may be a possibility. It would seem like we have to actually articulate that for the system before I might even attempt to experience that.
Well, I don't quite get how you do it.
Well, we have been educated to have an answer, okay? All my life, as soon as a teacher asks a question or whatever, if I have the answer, I'm, a good kid. And then I hear for the first time, whether it's here or so many years ago, that actually, if I don't have the answer, I'm a good kid, okay? So I am... I'm enlarging the system. I'm actually broadening it to include something new that I never even conceived would be a possibility. It was just such a small thing that I had learned that was so deep.
Well, Yeah.
Well, I'm just wondering, in a way, aren't we here doing two things, in a sense? We're actually hearing that it's okay, you know, that it might be actually interesting to be confused. See, if I'm anxious, it's going to be hard for me not to want to find an answer to something. So I'm going to see this movement and not have that have any space. And if I hear, well, maybe anxiety is okay, that in itself may actually reduce the anxiety.
In some cases, I think, but I mean, but when you're really anxious, I'm not sure it would work. You see, that is, if you've got some situation that produced, involving you, your interest very deeply, which was in danger, you know, that was real. See, if somebody, well, nowadays people may be anxious about losing their jobs, for example, and they could become very anxious about that. Now, they could think, well, being anxious is all right, but. I'm not sure it would help them very much at that level, you see.
No, I'm sorry. What I'm just suggesting is that if we hear within the system...
Yeah, I understand what you mean, yeah.
That not having the answer is not only okay, but it actually may have some deeper implications. Then to find myself in a situation where I would normally be anxious because I don't have the answer, there may be a willingness to drop trying to have the answer.
That might help, but I think that it wouldn't be enough to solve it. You see, I think it could help relax it a bit. And even there, I would like to say one more point, that it's not merely that you have heard that this is all right, but you must have seen that it's all right. You see, in other words, it would be still part of the system if you merely took my word that it's all right. You see what I mean? But actually, having heard it, you saw that it was, that it made sense, right?
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. You have to have a display, is what you're saying.
Well, but you have to see that it makes sense. You see that it's coherent. In other words, that this would be the coherent way to function or operate. To allow anxiety to be there, if you're anxious, you've got to say, that's it, I'm anxious. That's part of the whole situation, right? But then you have to notice that the mind is conditioned, or the system is conditioned to move away from that anyway. And that's also part of what you have to be aware of. So I was saying, by saying all this, we have begun to move. And by seeing it, and seeing that it makes sense, it's coherent, then a certain move has begun, loosening up the system.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's just what I was saying.
Yeah, I know. No, that's what I meant. It is what you're saying, but I put it in other words.
Oh, yeah, much nicer.
It shows that this system is not a monolithic rock wall, you see. It's actually really very not solid at all, you see, but it looks extremely solid.
You're asking whether we can learn to become more learning-oriented individually and collectively, rather than I know oriented?
Well, that's part of it. And the other part is to say that when we're looking into the impulses and feelings and anxieties which push us away from that. Instead of saying, that's terrible, I'm anxious, I must quickly find some thought that relieves the anxiety. Saying that anxiety is perfectly normal, and it's to be expected in this situation.
It's an opportunity to learn.
It's an opportunity to learn, yes. Now that's a reversal of most of our culture. So don't accept it, therefore, you see, but say if you see that it makes sense and it's coherent, it doesn't prove it's right, but say at least it suggests it's a good approach.
Right. Before, what you shun suddenly becomes valuable, as he said, it's an opportunity.
Yeah. You see, Krishnamurti used to use words like that, saying that envy or sorrow is a jewel. So you would say, how can he say such things? Terrible things, you see. But the point is that if you look at it differently, you can see that this is just what you've got to learn, what's going on there, you see, what it means. In other words, that all these things are now, the fact that you have all this going on which you don't really want is a sign that there's incoherence.
Are we saying that we call to us what we need to learn?
What?
Are we saying in a way that we call to us what we need to learn?
I don't quite get it.
I don't. I don't know how else to put it.
Recall, what was the words?
Well, do we attract what we need to learn?
Well, I think rather we acknowledge that things that seem things that we ought to get rid of are actually the clue to what we need to learn. You see, that our whole culture and our whole instinct has told us these are things we've got to get rid of as quick as we can. But now I've suggested reasons why maybe they are the things they're the source, the clue for learning. From there we can begin to learn.
And since we don't look at them, that's why we never do learn, right?
That's one reason, anyway. So at least that alone would explain. There are probably a lot of other reasons, but that's a point then, that it's part of the system. See, our whole culture is part of the system, isn't it? To say that that's what we should do, and in addition, there's some instinctive tendency in that direction, anyway. You know, to get rid of whatever is painful. Which makes sense in certain areas, say such as a toothache or something, to deal with the tooth, you see, to stop the pain, you see. But even there it could be wrong. If your only intention was to get rid of the pain, you might just use various drugs to relieve the pain until the tooth rots, right? You see. See, if the pain is an indicator of something wrong, it should be looked at in that way. Something which is not coherent, right, is going on.
That's interesting, because psychological pain is an indication of something wrong, but usually we try to think what the wrongness is, whereas the wrongness is the actual incoherent, the disturbance, which is a signal of the incoherent. Maybe
I
don't make sense.
Yeah, I understand. Yes. The point is this: it's very hard to get this straight, but we'll have to finish up in a short time now. The pain is in some way a sign that a result of a certain kind of incoherence. Maybe biological pain also very often is, because you have in the tooth some process, a bacterial process going on, attacking the cells, which is not coherent with their operation. And pain is a warning of that, right? Now, So pain, I think, in general, could be looked at that way, that pain... And there are people who cannot feel pain, and they really hurt themselves all the time. Their pain nerves are damaged. So, in fact, epilepsy seems to be that the pain, it's an attack on the nerves which prevents you from realizing and from feeling pain, so that these people destroy their muscles by using too much force. It's been observed, watched carefully, that the destruction of epilepsy comes from people using too much force in everything they do. Leprosy. Leprosy is the pain nerves are somewhat damaged by the disease, right? They cannot tell how much force they are using, and they have observed they're using fantastic amounts of force, which destroy the whole system. Therefore, you can see that pain has a necessary function. And the instinctive wish to get rid of the pain, which works in the animal level, is not working here with thought. Right? That instinct is not good enough. You see, you've got to... something much more deep and subtle is needed.
Pain could also be thought.
Well, thought can be painful, right? The thought of what an idiotic thing you've done, or you see, what a fool you've made of yourself, could be very painful, right?
Although in some other cases, it could be more like perception, something not so much coming from thought.
Yes, but even so, that pain is something to be perceived. Even if it comes from thought, there is a perception needed, you see, to learn.
Well, the pain doesn't come from thought. I'm just playing with it. the pain is something I generate in me in response to the thought.
Well, but it's part of the generalized thought in the sense I'm using the word, right? The whole bodily response.
But see, if I didn't understand that, I would try to solve the problem of the pain which I am generating through my thinking. Whereas I am, in a sense, deliberately paining myself in response to a thought, unbeknownst to myself.
Yeah, you're hurting yourself is a simple way to put it, that you see, and that's really, you know, so that...
Once this thought is there, doesn't it, once that image is there, isn't the response often immediate? I mean, it's not that we're doing it to ourselves so much as that the thought itself seems to bring physical pain, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, that's part of this generalized... I'm trying to say thought is never just thought, it's also the bodily state, the feeling. They say those nerves just... whatever's going on in the intellectual part just connects with everything else, right? It flows out so fast that you can't keep it in one place, right? So that a thought of a certain kind will produce either pleasure or pain.
You said that it gets involved.
At least the memory of it.
Isn't it an immediate thing, though? With that, I mean, it's directly wired into the nervous system?
Well, I don't know how fast it is. You see, it could take a second or two before you feel the pain. It takes a second or two for the impulse to get down to the solar plexus where you might feel the pain, you see. And you say, you know, my heart is broken or something.
Well, this is interesting then, because I think the question that was brought up, that maybe it isn't the thought then, but we are doing something if there's a lapse time there. That's what I'm wondering about.
But we're not doing anything. See, I will discuss that. It's all, I'm trying to get across a different picture, which is that it's one process, unbroken.
Right.
And we're not doing anything.
Okay. That's right? What I'm asking.
Yeah, it's going on by itself, but the thought is saying, we're doing it, right?
Right. No, that's... No.
What?
The thought is that it is being done to me, like you said something, and therefore I am hurt, and I actually physically hurt.
The thought is double. The thought is that the thinking is being done by me, and the pain is being done by you, right?
Whereas the pain is being done by me.
Well, by the same thought that that does it all in the first place, right?
This is because the emotion mediates the process that is so fast.
Well, the emotion is very fast, that's true, yeah.
The pain is always mediated by emotion.
Yeah, but it may take a second or two before, you know, the emotional center is hit very quickly, but then there's another center down in the solar plexus that takes longer. But anyway, I think we should not continue this, you know. I'm sure that people seem very interested, but it's 9:45, which is a bit later than we usually go. And we start, remember, tomorrow morning at 10. The place is open 9:30, right? And if during the night you go over this and think or feel some of it, maybe we could discuss it tomorrow, right? So we could start tomorrow by discussing whatever you may learn.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.